Of course, the Kemerit of Rav's Yahrzeit is to say over Divrei Torah in his name, and so that Sfasav Medovras Bekever. This was the Rav's own minig, as we know, that Gimel Shvat, which was his Yahrzeit for his father, was an important day on our calendar when the Rav would give the Yahrzeit shir. And we're going to begin with Rabbi Reichman, Rabbi Herschel Reichman, who was a Rosh Yeshiva, Yeshivas, and was a very close talmid of the Rav. He set over the Chazar Shurim for the Rav, and he has done an enormous amount in terms of popularizing the Rav's Torah and his Svarim, on Sukkah, Shavuos, Nedarim, and soon Baruch Hanukkah.
Thank you very much, Rav Ganach. And I thought that even though it's Pesach and we usually speak Minyan Diyoma, but since I'm preparing my next sefer on the Rishima Shurim of the Rav and Bava Kama, which is almost ready, hopefully we'll have it by Rosh Hashanah and Kippur, the Erev Chagim. So I thought, just as a little warm up, to give maybe actually the first piece in the sefer and to discuss it. And the topic is going to be Adam Hamazik. Now the first mission in Bava Kama has the four mazikim. Shah, Bar, Mava, Heber, various things that a person has in his rishus, and if he doesn't watch them, he has to pay if they damage other people's property. Let's say he has a fire, Aish doesn't take care of the Aish, it goes out and fire, it burns down his neighbor's property, he has to pay. And similarly, various Shah, an ox, Bar, digs a hole in the street, and some chips in it, and hurts himself, he has to pay for the damages. And there's a word in the Mishnah, which is an enigmatic word, says Mave. No one knows exactly what that word means. Machokas Rav and Shmuel in the Gemara. Rav says Mave is Adam and Shmuel says Mave is Shor. And concerning Rav's opinion that Mave is Adam means if a person does damage to someone else, he has to pay. And you would think that Adam and Mazik, if an Adam is Mazik, it would be the first of all the Mazikim. The person himself causing damage to someone else should have to pay. There is a question that the Rav raised on the Mishnah. Mishnah goes to we call it Tzad HaShava, and then it finishes off Tzad HaShava Shabran Shadakon Lahazik Shmirasun Olecha. But these various types of damagers, Mazikin, Shah, Bar, Eish, Maveh, have a common denominator, which is that their derech is to be Mazik and you have to watch them. And if you don't watch, you have to pay. So the Rav raised the following question. He says, I understand an ox, a ditch, a fire, if it's in my control, I own it or I made it, I have to watch it. If I don't watch it, the Torah says you have to pay. It's the Pashas Mishsefer Shemos, Pashas Mishpatim. But Adam HaMazik, the person himself goes and he smashes someone else's, let's say, he gets angry at somebody, goes and takes a baseball bat and breaks his window. So is he paying because he didn't watch himself? Shmirasin Olecha? He's paying because he broke the guy's window. He did a Maisa Hezek. Like a guy who goes and steals. You don't say he's stealing because he didn't watch himself from stealing. He pays because he actually did the action of stealing. It's the basic Maisa, which is Machayev. So too, if an Adam goes and is mazik someone else's property, it's difficult to say that he's paying because he didn't watch himself. He's paying because he did the Maisa Hezek. So why does the Mishnah, according to Rav, include Adam in the category of the four Mazikim as Shmirasan Olecha? And you have to watch it, and if he didn't watch it, he has to pay. It's sort of a backwards way of explaining Adam and Mazik. That you have to explain by a Shor, a Bar, an Eish. The owner himself didn't damage. What was his culpability for not taking care, not preventing those Mazikim from being Mazik, whether it's Eish, Bar, or Shor. But if he himself is the mazik, the Adam himself, the man himself goes and does the nezik, you don't have to say Shmirasa no lecha. And if he didn't watch, he has to pay. You can say simply he has to pay because he did the maisa hezek, he broke someone else's property, he has to pay the damages. So why does the Mishnah say Shmirasa no lecha when he's referring to Adam mazik? So this, of course, is rooted in this question. Does an Adam mazik pay because he does a Maisa Hezek, or perhaps he's really just paying because he didn't take care of himself, he didn't watch himself. Now there is a very interesting Rashi way out later on in the Masechta of Tzadik Ches on the Beis, in a little piece of Gemara which is discussing a different question about Hezek Shein and Nikos. Someone burns a contract and you have to pay because the contract doesn't really have intrinsic value, it represents other value. And the Gemara discusses that, and then the Gemara says, Rafram forced Rav Ashi to pay for burning the shtar, for burning a contract, made him pay. And Rashi says, what's going on? Rashi apparently was bothered. What, Rav Ashi was the Gadol Hador? He burned someone's contract? And he had to be forced by Rafram to pay? What's going on over here? I mean, how could this happen? So Rashi says, apparently on his own, Rashi says, Rav Ashi Sarav Shtar the Yalduso. Rav Ashi, when he was a young boy, Yalduso, he burnt the contract, and apparently no one had ever made him pay for this. And now Rafram, another of the Amoraim, decided the time had come, and he forced Rav Ashi to pay. And other Rishonim pick up on the Rashi and say that Rashi really wants to tell us a tremendous chiddush, that if a child, a yeled, the word yeled here might mean above or below bar mitzvah, but most of the Rishonim say Rashi means yeled, he means below bar mitzvah. If a child does damage, now the Mishnah says, also in Mishnah Baba Kama, cheresh shayta v'katan p'kiyasan ra, if a cheresh shayta v'katan get involved in damages, it's very bad, because heim shaziku acheim tum v'acheim shaziku oisam chayavim. If they're mazik other people, they're putter. But if other people are mazik a child, they have to pay. So Rashi and the Rishonim say that Rashi interprets that Mishnah to mean while he's a child and he damages someone else's property, you can't take him to Bezin, because Tanin Rabbanei, Tanin Ninu, you cannot take a child into court and have a lawsuit against the child. However, Rashi, and that's what the Mishnah meant by Kiyosam Rod, however, according to Rashi, if you delay the case and you wait till the child grows up, like apparently whoever it was, whose shtar was burnt by Rav Ashi when he was a boy, waited till Rav Ashi became a grown man, and then he brought him into court. You can't. You can take a child and sue him for damages that he did when he was a child below the age of bar mitzvah, and he has to pay when he's an adult. That's what Rashi holds. That's what the Rishonim say Rashi says. So, this of course is seemingly it's a startling opinion of Rashi, that children are responsible for damages. They just don't pay while they're children, but when they grow up, by the way, they have to pay. However, the parent, no one ever said that the parents have to pay, so we're sort of covered, we parents. You don't have to worry about it so much. But we should keep a record. If my child broke someone's window or did some other damage, I have to keep a record. When it comes to an adult, he's have to pay for it, according to Rashi. So the question is, in terms of the lumbus, in terms of the analysis of this particular sheet of Rashi, what does this mean? If we're going to, for example, there is a Mishnah which says, Shah shal cheresh shayta v'katan shaziku, taflam etes, the Mishnah says, Shah shal cheresh shayta v'katan shaziku ptulim. The child owns an ox, and this ox goes out and does damage, patur. And it never said that when the child grows up, he has to pay. It's patur. Because a cotton's not responsible, he can't impose on the child the obligation to watch. So even if his ox goes out, he was not a posheya. He had no chiyuv shmir in the first place. So therefore, if his, let's say, has a dog, and his dog goes and bites somebody, okay, if the dog would belong to the adult owner of the dog is responsible to keep his dog under a leash, muzzle, not to bite somebody. If he didn't watch his dog, he has to pay. But if a child didn't take care of his pet ox or his pet dog, he's perfect. And no one ever said that when the child grows up, he has to pay. However, Rashi said that if the child himself, with his own goof, his mazik, does damage, he has to pay when he becomes an adult. So how do we explain the difference between a shor of a child, a shor of a katan, that the katan is patur even after he grows up, and the katan himself is mazik, he has to pay once he grows up? What's the difference? So here the Rav said that the difference is, what's the source of the chiyuv? By an ox or a dog, the source of the chiyuv is the fact that the owner of the ox, the owner of the dog, did not fulfill his obligation to watch his animal. Since a child is b'chalal not chayiv and shmira, k'tan la b'nei shmira ninu, you can't impose chiyuvim of shmira on a child. If he didn't watch his ox, so he wasn't guilty, he wasn't culpable, and therefore he's patur l'olam goel. He doesn't have to pay for that. There's nothing which is machayiv. However, if he himself, with his own goof, goes and is mazik, let's say he went and burnt, as Rav Ashi did it when he was a child, he burnt this other guy's contract, with his own guilt. He's not chayav to pay because he didn't watch himself. The chayav is not because of lack of shiva. The chayav is a result of the maisa. He did a maisa. And a maisa hezek. And a child's maisa is a maisa. If a child does something, we don't say that it just happened in the blue air. This person, this human being, did it. He, as a child, did do it. He went and he broke that guy's window. He went and he broke the contract, burnt the contract, whatever he did. It's a maisa gavra. It's a maisa of this human being which relates to him as a human being. And therefore, if the maisa per se is machayef him to pay, he's chayef to pay. Except that as long as he's a child, we can't take him to court. You can't have a din Torah against the katan. So you have to wait till the katan comes of age. He's 13 years old. Then you take him to court. That's Rashi's shita. So according to Rashi, it's clear that the chi of mazik, of Adam mazik, is because of the maisa has a good shita. Not because of the fact that he failed to fulfill his chi of shmir. A similar machlokes, or question, comes up in the Mishnah Daf Chavav Amud Aleph. And that Chavav Amud Aleph, we have a Mishnah which says, Adam mu'ud li'olam, bein shogim, bein mezim. And the Gemara is ahead and add, bein ones, bein ratzon. If a person does damage, he is responsible to pay whether he did the damage for the mezid or the shogig. Whether he did it, he knew what he was doing, or he was under misimpression, he has to pay. Now, there's a big machlokas in the Rishonim. What does the Mishnah mean when it meant shogig, or the Gemara says ones? What level, or what reduced level of guilt is the minimal level for a person to be responsible to pay for damages? And the shittas vary. There are three basic shittas of Rishonim. The shita of the Ramban in his Chidushim in Bava Metzia is that a person has to pay damages for what he did, even if he did it under complete onus. It was completely innocent, completely not guilty whatsoever for what he did. If he broke, for example, I don't know, that happened once to me. I was driving my car and the brakes failed. Mamish, the brakes failed on me. What could I do? Boop! I drove into the car. I was coming out of some kind of a garage. The brakes failed, and I just started to drive, and boom, I hit the guy next to me. I'm mamish and honest. I didn't know the brakes were going to fail. No one told me this. No one, there's no warning whatsoever. Mamish and honest. There's no guilt whatsoever. So according to Ramban, Adam is chayiv. A person does a damage, but honest, he's chayiv. He did it. Tais v'shit is not that. Tais v'shit in Bava Kama Chav Zayin Rebeis is that you have to have a certain minimal level of pshia. Tosfos speaks about Kain Aveda. Like if he compares it to a shomer who misplaces something, forgot where he put it. So he lost it. So we know a shomer socher is chayiv for Aveda if he loses something. A shomer chinam who misplaces an object, forgot where it is, lost it, is potter. But there's a certain amount of pshia of negligence involved when you lose something. So Tosfos says, an Adam Mazik is also chayiv, but only if we can give him a certain level of culpability, to the extent it's comparable to as if he would have lost something which he was supposed to watch. So I guess according to that Tosfos, in my case, where I didn't know the brakes were going to fail, there was no warning I would be potter because it was what you call almost gone. However, if let's say I was supposed to do a regular, I hadn't checked my brakes in 5 years, I hadn't had my car into the garage in 5 years, so for 5 years I didn't check it, so I'm basically negligent. And if then the brakes fail and hit somebody, so then I'm guilty because maybe I wasn't amazing, I had no kavana, but certainly there's a certain amount of shia. So according to Tosfos, in order for other mazik to pay, you have to have a certain level of shia. Now we could say that the machlokes between these two opinions, the sheet of the Ramban, who said in other mazchayiv, in every onus, in every case of onus, and the shita of Tosfos, who says an adam is chayav only when there's a certain shear, a certain amount of shear, kain aveda, you could say that the machlokas is this particular nekuda, on this particular nekuda of our analysis, is the chayav of an adam amazik, a person who does the damage with his own body, is it because he did that maisa? He did the act of being of damaging somebody. If he did that maisa hezek, who cares? Who cares if there's no guilt whatsoever? He did the maisa. Because doing a maisa, an adam does a maisa, but onus, the person does a maisa, even if it completely, let's say, no conscious level of responsibility. No guilt is associated. But Maisa Onus is a Maisa Gavra, is a human being's Maisa. The Rav said many times, name Reb Chaim. One of the proofs to this is true is the fact that on Yom Kippur, we say, Al Chet Shechaton Fenecho Ba'ones Uberatzon. We ask God for forgiveness for doing sins which were done completely without any free will, just out of duress. I did a chet ba'onus. I asked the Kodesh Baruch Hu for Sticha Mechila v'chapara. So, a human being, if he does a maisa, it's his maisa. Whether or not his mind was in any way involved, because maisa adam is a maisa. It's called a maisa adam even ba'onus. That's what he said. Al chet shechaton ba'onus uberatzon. So if Adam is mazik, has to pay damages because he did a maisa hezek, even he was completely guiltless, he had no idea what was happening, but he did it, then he has to pay. This is according to Shita Rambam. However, if we say, and Adam is like any other mazik, not that you chayev to pay for doing the maisa, he's chayev because he didn't watch himself, because he was guilty, and he was posheya in his own shmira. So then there has to be a certain level of culpability. He has to be a posheya, some level of shia. That's what Tosfos says. Another mazik has to be posheya at least to the level, he says, ke'en aveda, as if he misplaced the chetz. Now, the third shita is the Nimuke Yosef. The Nimuke Yosef says that you can have even the most minimal level of guilt, of pshia. You have to have some level, but it could be much less than aveda. It could be, let's say, like a geneva. Like if a shomer is watching something and for some reason there was a break-in, and the Gemara says, ein l'ksof m'shmir ela b'kalka. A shomer, even if he has it in his house, and his house is locked with three locks, and the robber breaks in, the shomer socha, and steals, the shomer socha has to pay. Because kesef, he should have put b'kalka. It means he should have dug a hole, and maybe nowadays you should put it into a safe with in the bank with a big vault, but your own private house is not a shmira. You know, the level of guilt in such a case is very small because he had locks on his door. Okay, I mean sometimes the thieves are very graphic, they break in anyway and they find things in the house, so there's a small level of guilt of shia, but it's very minimal. But the Mugi Yosef says even if it's a very slight level of shia, however, he says, if it's on this gomer, if it's complete on this, no control whatsoever, then he's potter. This is the third sheet. Now, it could be that Nemuka Yosef disagrees with this Reb Chaim. Could be Nemuka Yosef holds the Adma Mazik is chayim for every Maisa that he does. However, if it's on this gomer, if it's so completely beyond his control, it's not a Maisa Adam anymore. I would say in Al Chesh, maybe on this he means there has to be a slight level of guilt, but complete onus where there's no responsibility whatsoever is not a Maisa Adam. And we'll soon see this will help us very much in Shita Rambam. In the Rambam, we have the following paradox, a tremendous theorem in Shita Rambam. In Hilchas Mazik, the Rambam writes, an Adam is chayev in Menezek, etc., in all cases, and he says, except in one case, he says, if a man is climbing up the ladder, and puts his foot on one of the rungs of the ladder, and it turns out that rung was eaten away, it was rotten. He had no idea, it looked perfect, he put his foot on it, and it turned out that there was worms or something in that rung, and it was eaten away, collapsed, and he fell on the ground, below him on the ground, there was a chreis, someone had something sitting there, and he fell on it, and he broke it. So, the Rambam says he's putter, because shezu mako b'dei shemayim, this is an onus which is b'dei shemayim. The man is completely guiltless and therefore he's potter. However, any case beyond that, even the slightest level of culpability, you're chayav. However, onus gomer, you're potter. It's apparently like Mukei Yosef Shita. Meanwhile, in another place, the Rambam writes the following very interesting discussion. Rambam writes in Hilchos Kodul Mazik Perek Vav. It's like this. The first halacha is Perek Vav. In another place, he writes that dealing with the problem of an informer, of a muscle, it's in Perek Ches, in Chol B'Lamatik. He says like this. A muscle, an informer, who informs another Jew, has to pay all damages which he caused this, his fellow Jew by informing on him to the authorities. Rebbe says, what happens if, let's say, the guy put a gun to the Musser's head and said, listen, if you don't inform on this other fellow's money and so on, we have his money, I'm going to kill you. It's a case of a Masira with a koch nefesh. Nope. So what's this Jew supposed to do? The guy is with a gun. Says, you don't inform and tell me where this other Jew has his money. I know he's a rich Jew, and I want his money. You have to tell me. And he puts a gun to his head. So Rambam says like this. He says that if he just tells the guy where the other Jew has his money stashed away, even because he did it under duress, he informed about his friend's money and his treasure to the duress. However, if the Muslim who is being forced goes for your dime and is no saver, no sendiyah, takes the other Jew's money and delivers it to the guy, then he has to pay. And the Rebbe starts screaming. He says, understand the difference? He says, kuach nefesh is matakolotar kula. I can be machal shabbos if a person has a gun in his head. So he was forced to take this guy's money and to deliver it. The guy told him, if you don't deliver it, I'm going to kill you. So kuach nefesh is a matir. So why should the Rambam pass that he has to pay? That's the right discussion. So the Mevashah Salavashik, the Rosh father, said that according to the Rambam, there are apparently two kinds of Masir. There are two ways of being informed. You can inform the pe. In other words, you give information. He's a skunk, a sneak. He gets information, passes it on, but he doesn't do anything himself. It's one kind of Masir. Then there's a Masir who goes and delivers the goods himself. He says there's a very big difference. The Masur who delivers the goods himself, he goes himself, takes the money, brings it to the guy. This kind of a Masur is a regular Mazik. He's a plain Mazik. He took someone else's money, be a diamond, was Mazik him. So forget the word Masur. He's a Mazik. And the Rambam Paskins, even though it's a case that we're talking about where he's being forced, but fed to his life, Mamish, but a Mazik, Ba'alus, it's Chayiv. Who says Onus Rachmana Patri? Onus Rachmana Patri just means that a Kaddish Baruch Hu doesn't punish someone who is being forced fed of his life. Or a Bezdin doesn't force, a Bezdin doesn't give you Onus Bezdin if it's Onus. But who says that you don't have to pay damages? Damages you have to pay. You have to pay damages because he damaged the other Yid, even though he was honest. Because the guy had a gun and said, unless you bring the money, I'm going to kill you. But the Meister, he was a Mazik. We don't have it in the terms of Lanao and Sasa Dava, is referring to Onsh, to punishments. But to pay Mazik is not an Onsh, not a punishment. You pay Mazik because you're a Mazik, not because it's an Onsh. So therefore, even though he did it under threat of life, he has to pay. This is a Masul be a dime. However, if he's Masul be a pay, he didn't take a be a dime. He just told the guy where it was. Then the guy went away, he sent the cops to take the money from the Jew, or the police, or the soldier. What did the Jew do? He was bepeh. Be'emes, in Hilchus Mazik, he's potter. Because grummer, words are not a mice of Mazik. Words are just a grummer. He told the guy information, and the guy acted on this information. So it turns out that the guy is the Mazik. The Jew is not a Mazik, he's only a grummer ba'alma. So therefore, in Hilchus Mazik, he should be potter. So, but there's a special takana called the takana of Masur that the Chachamim made a takana that anyone who's involved in the Masirah should pay. It's only when is that if he does it from his free will. If he, out of his own free will, he makes it a business to be a spy and to inform another Jew. So the Chachamim said such a dastardly person should pay damages for what he did to the Jewish community. In fact, the Chachamim made more takanas. He even said a Masur, sometimes you can even do other things to a Masur. I don't want to say, wow, can they arrest me? So, a Masur, you only allowed, but the Chacham made a takana of Masur. So therefore, but certainly to pay, but this is only if he does it out of his own free will. But if he's forced by the guy who holds the gun and says you have to do it, he's not a Muslim. You can't call him a Muslim if he's being forced. However, if he doesn't feel dying, it's a Maisa Mazik. So that's why the Rambam paskins that a Muslim under duress of Kuach Nefesh, if it's a Mesirah B'peh, Pot. If it's a Mesirah B'yadayim, it's Chayim. However, this shot, the Rambam, which resolves the right discussion, is difficult because it's a theory of the Rambam himself. Because the Rambam himself in Perek Vav, in Hilchos Chayav L'Mazik, in the case of the person climbing the ladder, paskin, that if the ladder collapses under no fault of the person, because of a Makkah B'day Shemayim, the Rambam paskin, this puzzle, means the Rambam psak is that Onus in Mazik, Adam who's Mazik, the Onus, the ladder collapsed, no fault of his own. Or like I said, in my case, I was driving the car, I just had the brakes checked out last week, and all of a sudden, today they failed on me. It's my fault. Here's an insurance man sitting here. Do I have to pay? What did they say? No, I checked it last week. I'm an onus. So the Rambam paskins that on a mazik ba'onus, the ladder collapsed, is pater. Because there's no guilt, it's pater. Onus achmona patre. So if the Rambam passes on a Sachmona Patre like the Mugay Yosef against the Rambam, he passes on a Sachmona Patre in other Mamazik in the case of the collapsing ladder. So why does he paskin that if a Masur who a Kuach Nefesh where the guy has a gun on his head and the Jew goes and delivers the goods, he's Nasur the Nasur Biyad, delivers the goods of the other Jew to the guy, Ram Tatan Zichayev, even though it's a Kuach Nefesh, the Rivas tries Chayev with Chayev, the Rivas screams, how can we be Chayev? Kuach Nefesh is Tercho Kol HaTor Kulo. So in the Chanami, it's mutter to do to save your life, it doesn't mean you're potter. You have to pay. The Ram Sheet is you have to pay. The Ram Sheet is, you have to pay, even though it's an onus of a Kuach Nefesh. So what's the difference if it's an onus of a Kuach Nefesh, and the Ram passes, you have to pay for your mazik, and onus falling off a ladder, which collapsed, you're potter in mazik. This is the kasha. This kasha, by the way, I believe was asked by the Makkah Mishnah, by the Tzolchin. So Rav said two interesting answers, two possible answers. Both answers are very important. One answer he said is there might be a difference between onus of a b'kuach nefesh and an onus b'day shemayim. What the Rambam calls Makkah B'day Shemayim, the ladder collapsed, no fault of his own, it's a natural event. When there's an onus of the kuach nefesh, in other words, the guy is forcing him to deliver the other Jew's money. You cannot say that the Jew who delivered the money did not do the maisa. He did the maisa. He decided to save his life because he didn't want the guy to kill him. And he went and he took the other Jew's money and delivered it. That's how he saved his life. Did he do the maisa? Mazik? He did it. There was a decision to do it. However, he was under duress for his life. There was an onus. But it's an onus which is achmona patre, lanao l'sasa davar, in other areas of the Torah. Malkus, kores, misa, all these other punishments under duress of kuach nefesh, onus achmona patre. However, paying damages is not an onesh. You don't pay damages because you're being punished. You pay damages because you hurt this other person's property, you have to pay him back. Not because you're being punished. It's not onesh. It's not an onesh. It's not an onesh that you pay damages. You pay damages because you did a maisa of being a mazik. So therefore, even if he does it under duress of the kuach nefesh, so he has to pay. He did a maisa. This is if it's the kind of onus of a b'kuach nefesh. However, if he's on a ladder, he's climbing the ladder, and through no fault of his own, the ladder collapses, this is an onus which the Rambam calls makah b'day shamayim. This is an onus which heaven calls. In other words, it's a natural set of circumstances where he has no decision. He turned into, so to speak, a chatzah. His body was taken by control of the elements, gravity and the forces of the rotten wood, and made him fall to the ground and be mazik. Such an onus which is an onus b'teva or onus b'dei shamayim, is already not a ma'isa adam. Then the adam action is not considered to be a ma'isa adam. He ceases to function as a human being. He now turns into a chesed. And therefore, any hesed which he does in this kind of a situation, he's pasuk. It's not a ma'isa. It's not a ma'isa adam. It's not a ma'isa mazik. So this is one possible answer. Another possible answer is, and this will close the circle and come to the conclusion. Another possible answer is that there's a difference. It's similar but a slight different emphasis. That there's a difference between the two cases. In the first case, the case where the gun was being held to his head, and he ran and delivered the other Jewish money to the gun. And here the Rambam passes chayiv. Even though it's a case of koach nefesh, which is honest b'chol haTorah kula, it's a question of a person's life. And it's certainly permitted to do, but because they did the ma'aseh, he has to pay. This case, according to the Rambam, the man did an action, the kum v'aseh. He did an action. He went and took the other guy's money and delivered it to the gun. Since he acted the kum v'aseh, and this is how he did the nezek, the chiyuv is a result of ma'aseh. The chiyuv to pay is a result of ma'aseh adam, ma'aseh mazik. Ma'aseh mazik, the onus, chayiv. To be explained, it's not an onus, it's not a punishment to pay. You pay damage and not cause a punishment because you did the damage. The ma'aseh itself is makes you pay. However, in the other case, in the latter case, where he's climbing the ladder, and the ladder then collapses, and he falls to the ground and breaks something on the bottom of the ladder. In this case, he functions the Sheva Altaisa. Because he did not exert any of his own energy. He didn't go and stretch out his hand and take something. The ladder collapsed and gravity pulled him down. So basically, he is turned into a passive mazik. He's mazik in a passive way. The weight of his body, which is being pulled to the ground by the collapse of the ladder, has broken the thing below. But he is not doing a ma'aseh b'kum v'aseh. He's being a mazik b'sheva al ha'aseh. Because his body has fallen to the ground and collapsed. It's not a ma'aseh adam b'kum v'aseh, but b'sheva al ha'aseh. Could be that adam who's mazik, when he does an action b'kum v'aseh, has to pay for the ma'aseh. However, an adam who is mazik b'sheva the Altaseh, in a passive way, he has to pay for not watching himself. He has to pay for lack of shmirah. And since in this case over here, you can't blame him for lack of shmirah. It was a makah b'dei shamayim. He was not guilty for falling off the ladder. You can't say it was poshe and his shmirah. So in this case, because of the lack of shmirah should make him pay, and in this case he didn't lack any shmirah, he's an honest, the ladder collapsed. Therefore, Ram Tassim's Tassim. Now it turns out, according to this final chart, that according to the Rambam, there are two kinds of Chiyuve Adam Amazik. There's a Chiyuve Adam Amazik who does a Maisa B'kum V'aseh. Then he pays for doing the Maisa. And the Chiyuve Adam Amazik who's Mazik B'sheva Altaisa because he's passive and somehow his body damages others. For example, it could also be someone just lays on the street. He lays on the street. And someone comes and trips over him and falls. That would be the second kind of Adam. It's an Adam b'sheva altaisa, because he didn't do anything, he just laid there and the guy fell over him. So he's a sheva altaisa. So when a person is mazik as a sheva altaisa in a passive way, he doesn't pay for the ma'isa hezek, he pays for the pshit. And in our case of makah b'dei shamayim, there was no pshit. Now that we know that the Rambam has two halachas of Adam ha-mazik, then we can go back to the original question. How can Adam ha-mazik be included in the list of the Mishnah before Mazikin? An Adam pays for doing a Maisa Ezek. Why is the Mishnah comparing him to a Shah and a Bar and an Eish? There's a difference. If he does the Mazik Bekum Vaseh, a Maisa Adam, has nothing to do with Shah, Bar, Eish. He pays because he's the Maisa Ezek. However, if he was Mazik B'Sheva Al Kaiser, he was passive, and the other fellow fell over him and was Nezek that way, then he has to pay for lack of Shiva. And that's why it's in the Mishnah, Atzad HaShav HaShabbat.
possible by cross counting.
Rabbi Yosef Adler.
The Rav, in addition to being an incredible Magid Shir in Inyoni Halacha, was also a master Darshan as well. And one thing that he always did in Maria was after he finished the Shir, he did a Shir for about an hour and a half, and then he always said something on the Parsha. And he always made a point of saying that he was going to say on the Parsha of the previous week, saying that I'm not about to feed this week's drasha to all of the practicing Rabbanim. If you can remember it for next year, that'll be fine. In the same vein, I'd like to share some thoughts with you which he said on the Haggadah, and I'm not feeding you for this year's Seder. If you can remember it for next year, by all means, hopefully you'll have an opportunity. In the few minutes that I've been allotted, just a couple of themes. And the Rav spent a lot of time teaching the Haggadah itself, not only from the halachic component of what's happening at the Seder, but trying to interpret the Haggadah itself as he did going through the Machzor and Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, interpreting Malchus, Zechoinus and Shofros, so that one gets a better understanding of what the text is trying to communicate. There was one of his favorite themes in the Haggadah. He developed through a Medrash incorporated in Parshas B'Shalach. The Pasuk states in Parshas B'Shalach, we'll read it, Shvi Shel Pesach, Vayasev Elohim Nisa'am Derech Amidbar Yam Suf V'chamushim Alu B'nei Yisrael Meretz Mitzrayim. Technically it means that HaKadosh Baruch Hu decided, on account of the fact that he was afraid that B'nei Yisrael would decide to go back to Eretz Mitzrayim if they encountered the Plishtim in battle, so he made them circle. Vayasev Elohim Nisa'am Derech Amidbar Yam Suf, took the circuitous route. The Medrash says, based on this phrase, Vayasev Elohim Nisa'am, Mikan Amru Afilu Ani Shebi Yisrael Lo Yochal Ad Sheyesev. From here, citing the Mishnah, the 10th parak of Pesachim, the beginning of Arei Pesachim, that from here we derive that even an Ani is not permitted to eat unless he will engage in Haseba, in reclining. And what a Chazal trying to tell us in associating Vayasev Elohim and Afilu Ani Shebi Yisrael Lo Yochal Ad Sheyesev, when it seems to be just playing on the words Vayasev and Achiyasev. So the Rav suggested in the following manner. We know that Aseba is one of the requirements to express Derech Erus. Supposed to exhibit certain types of behavior that lend itself to developing a certain feeling, a certain emotional state. You can have this Ani, and this particular Ani may not know where his next meal is coming from. After all, he's taking Minatamchui, so he barely has two sudos worth. And you expect the person, just because it happens to be Leil Pesach, to forget about all of his problems, doesn't know, he may not have a roof over his head, doesn't know where his next meal is coming from, and you expect him Pesach at night to engage in Haseba. It's nothing but a joke. How do you expect somebody to engage in meaningful expressions of chayrus under his particular conditions? So therefore the Medrash is telling us that the individual, the yachid, has to somehow gain strength from the tzibur, from Klal Yisrael. Here you have Klal Yisrael leaving Mitzrayim. They expect that their next destination is Eretz Yisrael, and as was initially designed, Derech Shloshis Yomim Nelech, that 3 days travel will be in Eretz Yisrael. And suddenly, all of a sudden, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, no, Vayasev Elohim Nisa'am Derech Amid Bar Yam Suf, and one never knows as to whether one is going to arrive at one's destination or not. And this happens to Klal Yisrael several times during the course of their travel in the Midbar. They expect to go in, something happens. And nonetheless, despite the fact that Am Yisrael were incredibly disappointed, and that they'd not reached their target of reaching Eretz Yisrael, nonetheless, it came Pesach at night, and it came Shvi Shel Pesach. They understood that this is going to be Kriyas Yamsuf, and one is obligated under those circumstances to sing Shira to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to offer Shevach Lanidah to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, based on your current, even mini Geula. So therefore the individual has to now derive the same type of courage. That even though he may not know where his next meal is coming from, even though he doesn't know how he's going to survive tonight, this Pesach at night, And no matter how difficult an individual finds himself, nonetheless, he is obligated to muster sufficient energy and understanding that Leil Pesach, one has to go ahead and focus on the Simcha of Yetzias Mitzrayim and offer Shevach L'Naidah to HaKadosh Baruch Hu in this fashion. And along these lines, he said something which was always made an incredible Rosham, and I say this very frequently. The Rambam emphasizes that the Nusach of the Haggadah which we use is the Nusach Haggadah of Bizman HaGolus. This is the text of Am Yisrael's Haggadah Bizman HaGolus. And there are many proof texts to the fact that in effect our Haggadah lends itself to a more Golus experience as opposed to Am Yisrael sitting in Eretz Yisrael under an autonomous government, for example, like Shlomo HaMelech. The Haggadah is not recorded for that type of an environment and atmosphere. And one of the ideas which he often developed to show how much we expect of members of Am Yisrael on Pesach at night, no matter how difficult the situation is the selection of the name of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Baruch HaMakom. The name Makom appears very frequently within the Haggadah. V'achshav kevanu ha-makom la'avodasai, baruch ha-makom, and so on and so forth. And he asked the question, why do you call HaKadosh Baruch Hu a makom? Why is HaKadosh Baruch Hu? Could have said, first that's one question, it could have said, baruch Hashem, baruch Elokeinu, and so many baruch tzva'os, any name of HaKadosh Baruch Hu would have been just as appropriate. Why baruch ha-makom, baruch Hu? And he developed the following idea. The Gemara Chagiga compares two Nevi'im, Yeshayahu and Yechezkel, and describes one of them as the Ben Kfar and the other one as the Ben Krach. Yeshayahu is called the Ben Krach. Why? If you look at the beginning of Perek Vav of Yeshayahu, where it describes his first Gilui Shechina, first encounter with HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Nevuah, so it doesn't take him very long to develop what he's experienced. It's two or three psukim. It's the Haftar of Parshas Yisro, you can look at it. He simply says, "Vishulav Malayim Esahechal, Srapim Omdim Amal." Very simple, and all of a sudden, the next pasuk, "Kadosh, Kadosh, Kadosh, Hashem Tzvos Malach Al Aretz Kvodo." So Yeshayahu is called the Ben Krach. Why? If you grow up, if you live on 72nd Street, and you work in the Empire State Building or in the World Trade Center, so then when you come home after a day's work, you don't describe to your kids, "You know, I saw the World Trade Center today. I saw the Empire State Building." Well, you see it every single day, so it doesn't make much of a rush. So similarly, Yeshayahu offers Nevuah when the Beis HaMikdash is standing, and he says, "Meloi Chal Aretz Kivodo." So if Meloi Chal Aretz Kivodo, what's the big deal that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is being Megala His Shechina to me personally? Everybody can, in effect, feel Shechina of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. As a result, he doesn't take much time to describe what it felt like to experience Gilui Shechina. Whereas Yechezkel, as he says in his opening pasuk, V'ani b'sol chadola, and he offers prophecy after the Churban Abayis, he never knows whether HaKadosh Baruch Hu is ever going to return to him. And that's why when he sees Gilui Shechina, for him this is something startling, something an incredible encounter, and it's to be compared to the Ben Kfar. Somebody who grew up in Billings, Montana, where the tallest building is three stories high, he comes to the Big Apple, and he can't stop talking about the Chrysler Building and the Empire State Building. He can't stop talking. So Yechezkel also, two prophets, he describes the Maaseh Merkava. And as a result, all of Kabbalah, based on Maaseh Merkava, what Yechezkel saw. And what does he say at the conclusion of his first Gilui Shechina? Baruch Kivod Hashem Mimkomo. Which the Rav said meant Mimkaimai Hanistar. That wherever HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to be in hiding, I may not be privileged to Gilui Shechina ever again. But that doesn't mean that I or Am Yisrael are going to abandon faith. I'm going to praise HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Baruch Kivod Hashem Mimkomo. So the word makom has been designated as a reference to HaKadosh Baruch Hu when we refer to HaKadosh Baruch Hu in effect behest upon him. Therefore you come to be Menachem Avel, we don't say Hashem Yenachem Elokeinu Yenach, HaMakom Yenachem Eschem, B'sar Shal Veritzin L'Shalayim. We recite every Monday and Thursday, Achenu Kol Beis Yisrael, HaNasunu Batzor V'Shivya, Om Demei Bayam Uvein Bayavasha, Hamakai Mirachim Aleim Biotziim Mitzaru Levacha. Because for that family who unfortunately sitting Shiva, there was no Gilui Shechina. There was some degree of Hester Panim. If there had been a full Gilui Shechina, the tragedy perhaps would never have happened. So as a result, we offer Nichum, but Hamakai Mirachim. Same thing said the Rav Pesach at night. Come to the Seder, it's not for sitting back in your lounge chair, it's the Nusach HaGad of Bizman HaGolus. Try to capture that Seder in the Warsaw Ghetto in 1943. Just try to capture it for a minute. Of what Am Yisrael went through at that time. Knowing that what they were about to suffer was far worse than anything that any Jew in Mitzrayim ever experienced. We have no evidence in the Chumash that one Jew ever died in Mitzrayim. In fact, quite the contrary. It says, Paru vayishritzu vayirbu vayatzmu b'mor ba'ol. We don't find that Paru succeeded in all of his attempts to eliminate Am Yisrael. It was quite the contrary as to how they multiplied. In fact, I read once, it was a sociologist at Yale University. He wrote a paper, and he said that this particular medrash must be true. That they were yole b'sh... Despite the fact that if a person is found in a state of total hester panim, it's difficult to see HaKadosh Baruch Hu, nonetheless, we are able to recognize that Leil Pesach, you put away all of your personal problems and focus on the chiyuv of Sipri Yetzias Mitzrayim and offering Shevach and Aidah to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Similarly, developed a wonderful theme in trying to explain the opening drash of Arami Yoivinovi. We know that it's one of the important themes of Leil Haggadah. The Rambam even says that a kolamarbe in Bidrash Parsha Zu Hareza Mishubach above and beyond of kolamarbe l'sapa b'tias Mitzrayim. So we read Arami Yoivinovi, and the Baal Haggadah says Sheparo le'gazer al azcharim v'lavon bikesh la'akar esakol. And you try to gain understanding, where in the world did Lavan try to be Bikesh Lachor Sakol? The Baal HaGadah doesn't tell us. So of course everybody is familiar with the Medrash that when Eliezer came to seek a Shidduch for Yitzchak, so then Lavan wanted to poison Eliezer, and the Malach came and switched it, and the Suel died, and so on and so forth. Okay, and what would have happened had Lavan succeeded? So then Yitzchak would never have known who he would marry and so on. This would be Bikesh Lachor Esakol. There would have been no one suitable to marry Yitzchak other than this person, and Eliezer would be dead and no one would know who Yitzchak is supposed to marry. That would be the end of Knesset Yisroel. So the Rav, he didn't actually say it on this particular phrase, but he said it on Parshas Vayetze. So I allow myself the liberty of just linking the two. At the end of Parshas Vayetze, we know that Yaakov leaves Lavan's house, and suddenly he travels a couple of days, and Lavan pursues Yaakov, and he's very upset why Yaakov did not even say goodbye, and he uses the following expression: Habanos binosai, habanim banai, kol asheratos alihu. Everything that you have belongs to me. Very nice. And then he says, L'cha v'nichrasa baris aniva ata. Let's establish a covenant. Me and you, Yaakov and Lavan. And Yaakov agrees. And what happens is they take rocks and they build a matseva. Vayirimeha evan vayatva, and they build a matseva. And then the pasuk says that Yaakov called it Gal'ed. The Lavan karala yigar sahadusa. So Rashi simply says that Yigar Sahadusa is the exact Aramaic equivalent of Gal'ed. And the Rav suggested something else. It was in a Mariah Shir, it was the beginning of Tuesday night of Parshas Vayishlach. He said this on Vayetze. So he said as follows. There are two reasons as to why people make covenants. One reason you make a covenant is because you want to establish relationships with people. So if you have the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, that covenant, that pact is made so that there will be some degree of concern and consideration that if one of the member states are attacked, everybody else will respond in kind. That's one type of a pact, of a covenant. Then there is another type of a covenant which you make, which you say, we have nothing to do with each other, but instead of trying to destroy and eliminate each other, let's agree that you stay where you are, I'll stay where I am, and we'll be able to live Shalom Yisrael for the rest of our lives. Lavan, when he decides to make the covenant, what is the symbol of his covenant? It's the gathering of the rocks. The gathering of the individual rocks is now the symbol of the covenant. In other words, I want you, Yaakov, to recognize Habanim Banai, Habanos Binosai. We can continue to interact. We can intermarry. There is nothing wrong with it. The two families are indeed one. But Yaakov understands that that's not the purpose of the covenant. The purpose of the covenant is to create a barrier. Not the gathering of the rocks, which is the symbol of the covenant, but the mound which has subsequently been formed is now the symbol of the covenant. I'm creating a barrier between myself and yourself. I don't want to have anything to do with you. Therefore, later on, look as to who each one identifies as the symbol of the covenant. Lavan swears, Elohe Nachor Yishpetu Beneinu, and Vayishava Yaakov Befachad Aviv Yitzchak. Yaakov didn't even want to mention Avram, because Avram early in his life was also an idolater. But Yitzchak was, Kulei L'Shem Shemayim. So Lavan identifies an individual, Elohe Nachor Yishpetu Beneinu, because the essence of the covenant is bringing together people who are idolaters and those who believe in monotheism, and we can merge the two families. And Yaakov said, absolutely not. The only model that I have is Yitzchak, who has nothing to do, no interaction with anybody, remains in Eretz Yisrael all his life, and is never involved with any interaction with anybody less than the committed member of what is the beginnings of Am Yisrael. Had Lavan succeeded in convincing Yaakov that there is the right way to go is to intermingle the two families, that would have been the beginning of the end of Knesset Yisrael. And therefore, what the Baal HaGadah says, Arami Yoved Avi, Lavan Bikesh La'akor Esakol. Lavan attempted to eradicate everybody, because had there been a covenant, a pact, whereby individuals would recognize that there is no reason to segregate, that one can interact, intermarry with all of the nations of the world, that would have been the downfall of Knesset Yisrael, and as a result, undoubtedly would have been the end of Klal Yisrael, and therefore perhaps this is what the Baal HaGadah has in mind, that Lavan Bikesh Lakor Esakol, had he succeeded in that particular regard. And finally, one other major thought that the Rav always developed in the Haggadah was interpreting what the word Haggadah means itself. We're always accustomed to translating the word Haggadah based on the pasuk v'higadata levencha, so it's the telling of a story. However, on account of the fact that we select the psukim of the bikurim, the mikra bikurim, to serve as the basis of the drasha parshas Arami Yavid Avi, so there in the parsha bikurim, the pasuk says higadati hayoyim l'ashem alokecha kivasi el aretz. What does it mean there? It's not that I'm telling any stories. It means I'm serving as a witness. I'm offering testimony. That when somebody brings Bikurim unto HaKadosh Baruch Hu, he's bringing testimony that he indeed acknowledges the fact that in HaKadosh Baruch Hu took us out of Mitzrayim, brought us into Eretz Yisrael, and I thank HaKadosh Baruch Hu for once again for an incredibly successful harvest. And this he always used to link with the famous Rambam's emendation of the Mishnah Psachim. The Mishnah Psachim, the way our Haggadah has it, says that the Chodar Vadar Chayav Adam Liro Sasatzma Kiilu Hu Yatzim Mitzrayim. And the Rambam's famous version is Chayav Adam Laharos Esatzmo Ki'ilu Hu Yatza Ata Mi Mitzrayim. And the reason the Rav said was very simply: if you want to serve as an aid, you can't hear stories what somebody else told you. Aid mi pi aid, hearsay is not acceptable in Beis Din. The only way for you to be Magid Eidus, that you believe that HaKadosh Baruch Hu took out of Mitzrayim, is to be an observer of what actually took place. So the whole challenge Leil Pesach is to in effect try to recreate not a story of what happened, but to believe in our own minds that we're actually going out of Mitzrayim to experience it to such a point so that therefore I could qualify in Beis Din in offering Haggadah Eidos and offering Eidos to an individual, and under those circumstances fulfill the mitzvah of Haggadah in light of the fact of Higadati Ayom Lashem Elokecha.
I want to first take this opportunity to acknowledge the presence of many of the local rabbonim, Rabbi Golden, Rabbi Yudin, Rabbi Weinberger, and also Rabbi David Feldman, and Rabbi Santa. I also want to acknowledge the presence of my chavrusa, Rabbi Cohen, and also Rabbi Barry Reichman, who are Talmid Mitzvah during my sojourn there. As I think about the Rav, there are always two Yom Tovim that come to mind, and they are Yom Kippurim and Pesach. I'm going to say first a short Vat Torah from the Rav and try to link the two, and then reminisce just very briefly about the Rav. And this is with your side. The Torah tells us, that whenever there's an Isur Achila in the Torah, or not only Isur Achila, even beyond Isur Achila, there's always a certain amount that has to be done. There's a certain shear. Chatzi shear, if I don't eat the full amount, or if I don't violate the whatever that standard is, for example, I exceed the Shtei Oisius for Ksiva and Achila Shabbos. So that's Chatzi shear. The Yochim holds Chatzi shear Osim in Torah, and the Shlokish says it's only Osim in Rabbanah. We pass him like the Yochim with Chatzi shear Osim in Torah. We learned this from a pasuk called Chelav Choldam, that's Ma'av v'chatzi shir as well. Now, the Rav said, based on the Rambam, and this may be a machlekes Yerushalmim, that the halach of chatzi shir, there are two ways that we can interpret chatzi shir. Is chatzi shir that the halach is if I eat on Yom Kippur, it's at the shir, so if I eat koseves hagasor, so it's an isekoros, or if I eat chelev kezayis, it's an isekoros. If I eat chatzis shir, I'm over on the diraisa. Just chatzis shir, there's no malchus. I didn't violate the shir, the entire isa, so there's no malchus. But the isa that I violated is an isa yom kippur or an isa chelev. It's the isa, the specific isa of which I ate, but I didn't eat the shir. Or we can interpret, no. In order to violate the isa chelev or on a vela or any other Isa in the Torah, which the Torah designates as shear, I have to eat the entire shear or transgress it, you know, commensurate with the amount that's required. This is a new Isa. It's a universal, generic Isa called Chatzis Shear that we learn from called Chela V'Choldam. So the Rav said that he, in name of his father, that this Shaila came up in Kippur. What about a Chela Shiesh Osakana, a Chela who's permitted to eat on Yom Kippur? So the halacha is, based on his father, we feed him Pachas Pachas Mikashir, assuming of course that you know that's sufficient to sustain him. I'm not going to under which circumstances the Rav said you eat Kashir, but under certain circumstances, as the Gemara says, it's only Pachas Pachas Mikashir. Let's say such a man had a heart condition, he couldn't fast Yom Kippur, we gave him Pachas Pachas Mikashir. Is he allowed to daven the Ilah? The Ilah is uniquely a Tefillas Hatayinus. So the Rav said from his father that such a person, which is a common occurrence for Rabbanim in terms of their congregations, to have such people at the Pachas Pachas Mashiach, that he can daven Ilah. Even though the halacha is that one who doesn't fast on Yom Kippur is not allowed to daven Ilah, because Ilah is uniquely a Tefillah Satayinus. But the Rav said from his father that if he eats Chatzis Shir, he hasn't violated an Isur Yom Kippur at all. It's a generic Isur. It's called Chatzis Shir. But the Isiyam Kippur he hasn't violated, and therefore he's a kind of assay of Inuyam Kippur as well, and therefore he should daven. This is a shaila, by the way, in Poskim. This was the Rav's opinion, and he based it on the Rambam. That the Rambam says that if you take the Torah says, Malach is if I take a Shvuah to Mevatel and Isu the Torah, that's called a Shvuah Shav, and it's not Chal. However, if I take a Shvuah, the Rambam says, not to eat, in other words, to eat Chatzis Shir, so that's not called Nishpil Matlis and Mitzvah, because the Ram says it's not Mufurish B'Torah. Either is an Isur Chatzis Shir, but it's, the Ram interpreted that to mean that it's not an Isur Tvoti, to use his parlance, a specific Isur of Yom Kippur. Now, the Rambam in Hilchos Chometz and Matzah, when he quotes the halacha of eating chometz pachas mikshir, says ha'ochel min ha'chometz atzmo pesach kolshu hareza osim na torah shenema lo yeyochel. The Rambam says it's forbidden to eat chatzishir kolshu of chometz, and what's difficult is the Rambam quotes a special pasuk lo yeyochel. And the case of Mishnah there is kashli lamani kvar b'chometz. We have a general halach we know in all these surim from Kol Chol and Kol Dam that Chatzishir is also. Why does the Ram quote as relates to Chometz a specific pasuk of Lo Yochel? So the Rav suggested that maybe he gave two answers on this. I saw that one of these answers the Chaim Oizer gives in the Achi Ezer. One answer he suggested like this, that it may be indeed as we saw from the Ram by Shvuah, that Chatzis Shir is not a specific Isur, but a generic Isur. But he said, as relates to Yom Kippur, Chatzis Shir is a specific Isur. So even though in Echanami, Chatzis Shir, as relates to Chometz, it's a specific Isur. So even though it would have been also independent of this possible Lo Yochel, because it falls under the rubric of Kol Chel V'Kol Dam. But the reason the Ram quotes a specific pasuk lo yochel is to tell me that this is if I eat chatzishir, there's a specific ish of chatzishir, and the nafkamina will be lenu shvur, where the shvur will be chal, as relates to chatzishir, shvur will not be chal, chatzishir chometz. The other possible answer to the Rav said is like this. You know, there's a Yerushalmi, we pasuk like this Yerushalmi. The halacha is, the Yerushalmi says you're not allowed to feed chometz to an animal on Pesach. And Yerushalmi says, not on my own animal. I'm not allowed to feed my own animals chametz because then I'm being nene from the chametz. And chametz is also b'hanor. The Yerushalmi says, even behemoth hefker, you're forbidden to feed. I'm not deriving any benefit. It's not my behemoth. It's hefker. It doesn't belong to anybody. Yet the Yerushalmi says it's forbidden to feed such an animal, hefker chametz. So the Rav said, why is it forbidden? So he said, it's not because there's nisamo. There's no anor. The halacha is, and Yerushalmi learns it from this, indeed from this very pasuk, lo ye ochel. Right? It should not, the Torah doesn't say don't eat it, it says it should not be eaten, chametz on Pesach. Because the halacha is not just the halacha in the gavra that he should not eat chametz. The halacha of chametz is that we're so distant from chametz, so to speak, we should see to it that we should not be responsible for the fact that chametz is eaten. And achilas behem is also called achila. So therefore, it's not a derivative of Isa Hanor, but rather, it's a separate Isa. The Taz, as a matter of fact, suggests that this halacha, he quotes the Yerushalmi, he says it may be by all macholos asuris, by all Isur Hanor, that you're not allowed to feed it to behemoth hefker. He says it in Bosa B'chol, in Yerodeya. You couldn't take Bosa B'chol, but Tosa B'Hanor, Bosa B'chol to your Isa, and feed it to behemoth, because that's, he assumes it's part of the Isa Hanor. In other words, somehow I get Hanor. What Hanor? Maybe psychological Hanor, that I go to the zoo and I feed the animals. Not a monetary Hanor. But the Goyin is not that way in Shulchan Aruch. The Goyin says it's specifically Halacha on Yom Kippur. So you see it's a separate Halacha, excuse me, on Pesach. So you see that it's a specific, it's a Halacha not to see to it that Chometz is, that the Chometz is eaten. It's Halacha on Chefza. So the Rav said, it could be, this is the same Halacha as relates to Chatzishir. It's indeed learned from the same Pasuk. This is not Halacha in Gavra. In the Gavra, that's a general Halacha of Chatzishir. But we learn from Kol Chelev. The Rambam, based on the Yerushalmi, is saying there's a separate halacha that chometz should not be nechal for havaya. It shouldn't be nechal even on yidei behemah. Behemah is hefker. Similarly, in gavra, there's a halacha how much you have to eat, namely kezayis. But vis-a-vis the chefter is consumed if it's less than the kezayis as well. And therefore, in chefter, there's an isur chatzishir because the chefter is being nechal. In this question, whether chatzishir is an isur prot and isur klali, I remember I once spoke to the Rav about this. I mentioned to him that in the Ramban, in Torah Sa'odon, has a suffix. In this halacha on Yom Kippur, that you're allowed to be Michael Achoyla, or in general, that you're allowed to be Michael Achoyla, Yisurin, Pikuach Nefesh, but nonetheless you have to, as much as possible, mitigate the Isa and be Michael him, Pachis Mikashir. The Ramban has a suffix. What if I have Chatzishir of Chelev and Chatzishir of Nevela? do I have to prefer giving him the chatzi shiv nefela, which is only nisa lav, rather than chelev, which is a more severe isa? Chelev is a nisa koras. So the Ramban has a suffix about this. L'chore, this suffix should revolve around this issue. Because if it's a generic isur, not a specific isur, a chelev or nevela, so it's a generic, there's no, once you're on the level of chatzi shiv, there's no distinction. But if it's a specific isur, so chelev, which is nisa koras, is more severe than nevela, and therefore you should prefer to give him the nevela rather than chelev. And the Rav told me, no, it's not mukach. It could be indeed that the Ramban thinks that in both stotim, that he thinks it's a specific issue, not like the Rambam. In other words, not a, what the Rav would call an isur below shem, not a specific isur, but rather a generic isur below shem. But the Ramban says, suffix is what's called chomer. Why is chelev more chomer than nevela? Because chelev brings chorus. Chatzi shir, anyhow, there's no onshin. It's not inherently the Shem Ha'isuf Chelev, therefore it's more chomer. So on the level of Chatzi Shir, even though one is called Chelev and one is Nevela, but on that level, one is not more chomer than the other. Or maybe not. That's the suffix of the Ramban. Now, it's interesting, just in the Mishnah itself, by Yom Kippur, I mean, the Mishnah learns that Chatzi Shir, the Mishnah Yom Kippur says, Tznan, Yom Kippur also b'achila b'shtir b'chitzu v'sicha, and the Gemara asks, what do you mean Yom Kippur is also b'achila b'shtir also mashma? It's forbidden. It's more than forbidden. Achila, as opposed to the other minuim, is nisakoros achila b'shtir. Gemara asks, achila nisakorosu. So the Gemara says that it's coming to be ma'aver to include chatzi shir. The simple reading of the Mishnah would be, it would seem that it's a specific. So this is a Mishnah in Yom Kippur. It would seem that you're violating Yom Kippur halacha, not what the Moshe said. But if you look in the Achiezer, the Achiezer has discussion about this mission. He indeed comes out like the Rav that it's a generic Isha, and you do not violate the Isha Yom Kippur. He quotes a Rivash like that. And again, in Afgamina, lenient Shavuot. I just want to mention parenthetically, the Gemara asks in Sochim. There's one opinion in Tanoim, the opinion of Rabbi Yossi of Lili, that says that chametz is mutter b'hanah on Pesach. We don't pass it that way, but God says, how can it be that chametz is mutter b'hanah? The Torah says lo yei ochel, or according to the chiskit in the yochel, from which we always derive the isa hanah. So the more answers that according to Rabbi Yossi of Lili, since it says lo yei lacha, right? Lacha means to you, apparently, that you have ownership. If it was osa b'hanah, you couldn't have ownership on it. Tosis asks, if that's so, according to who that we derive the Issa Hanor from the fact that it says Lo Yeyochel, why does the Torah have to give me an extra, stipulate an extra Lacha, from which we learn that it's Mutter B'Hanor? Tosis says, according to Yossi Lili, didn't have to say Lo Yeyochel, let it just say Lo Yochel, and then you don't derive an Issa Hanor, according to Babu. So I just want to suggest that according to the Yushalmi, the reason the Torah writes Lo Yochel, because it derives another halacha from that, that the nature of the Issa is not only that there's Nisa Anor, but if it would be consumed even by an animal, it's also forbidden. Now, you know, there's a very remarkable dimension to the Yom Kippur Pesach, and that is that there are extraordinary ironies within the yontif itself. I'll just mention one just in terms of the story itself. You know, Paulo, listening to the prophecies or the prognostications of his astrologers, once that ultimately the Redeemer, his ultimate nemesis, will be born amongst the Jews who will ultimately challenge him, he wants to see to it, because the astrologers see that whoever this person is, this nemesis, that person will be subdued, that man will be subdued by water. Now these astrologers glimpse the truth, but in their clouded vision, not the complete truth, because indeed Moshe Rabbeinu, the ultimate redeemer of Klal Yisrael, is going to be punished because of water, namely that he hits the rock rather than speaking to the rock to give its water. But Paulo wants to make sure that this person is stillborn, and he cruelly orders that all of the male children of the Jews should be thrown into the waters of the Nile. Because of that, his parents, hoping to save their new infant child, put their son in a wicker basket in amongst the reeds, watched over by mother and sister. And Paro's daughter goes to bathe at the Nile, sees this infant child, brings her to her home, adopts him, and raises him as his own. Listen to the extraordinary irony the Torah is pointing out. In other words, Paro, in his attempt to destroy this threat, brings this threat even closer to him. Why was Moshe there to be found by the daughter of Paro? He's brought into the house of Paro, ensconced comfortably and safely, to learn loyalty, to learn leadership in the house of Paro, ultimately to challenge Paro. Paro thinks that he can push God's hand, force God's hand, but Atzis Hashem, he succumbed. Ultimately, Paro brings the threat closer to him and teaches this young prince, this prince of Egypt, to challenge him and to ultimately to destroy Paro's entire empire. These were the ironies that are just, they're woven into the story of Pesach, the story of our redemption. Halachically, the dynamic that we read about, or that we read the halacha between Pesach and Morah, between Korban Pesach and Morah, Pesach representing the ultimate geula, Morah representing the Shibud Mitzrayim. How is it that they, how do these two antithetical notions live together? But the answer is, there's a dual answer. One answer is that we as Jews have always lived within the tension of such contradictions, both in terms of religious experience as well as in terms of our history. And that's how we can somehow survive the night of Pesach, even in the most pressing of circumstances, celebrate the Geula itself. And Morah represents the theme of Morah is that even in our moments, beyond the antithetical dimension of Morah and the Geula of Pesach, is the notion that even in the depths of our subjugation, in the nadir of our existence, this Morah also has a theme of Geula, because God never abandoned us. V'hotzeisi Eschem Nokud Behutseisi Itchem. Even within the Morah, there's this quality of faith that Kadosh Baruch was always with us. That Rabbi Kiva, with his vision, could see when he saw the Churban Habayis and laugh and see that even within the utter destruction of the Beis Hamikdash, phoenix like, the Jewish people could arise. These are the ironies which within Pesach, which I think intrigued the Rav. The thing that, you know, in terms of the Rav's thought process, it was true in his halachic thinking, it is true in his hashkafic thinking. It was what struck him so much was the mystery of life, and most specifically the mystery of our relationship with Kadosh Baruch Hu. Here is man, mortal, frail man, as he always would say, the Rav, the Sigurd Lishner, Hayom Kanu Mocha Bakeva, today here, tomorrow in his grave. And he would be, and so frail, seeking out Kadosh Baruch Hu, but God is ultimately unreachable, unknowable, finite, limited man can't grasp or even completely relate beyond the Torah to Kadosh Baruch Hu. And it's that irony, that tension, that was in the Rav's mind, which represented the whole majesty of the religious experience. And it's true also even within his halachic thinking. You know, he was always the paradox, always. It was the paradox that intrigued him. You know, one of the notions that the Rav developed was the halacha of shtar. And shtar is really, you know, it's a paradox. How I give the shtar point to the Rav, Chaim developed this, would speak about things that neither the person who wrote the deal or the person who received it knew anything about. The shtar would be made, very non-common sense notion, about things that hadn't even happened yet. The shtar would be made lo paraiti, not just a circumstantial evidence. That would be part of goof of the Hagodish Tashtar, or Halay Eidech of Ishtar's Machai Shvuah. So that's part of the Hagodish Tashtar. And he would be so intrigued by this notion, of Shtar. Because, you know, this man who was such an aristocrat, such an absolute extraordinary genius, literally without peer, I mean, his genius, whatever he touched was just, was there was just no one like, you know, the Rav, the incredible thing about the Rav, Dr. Lamb once pointed this out to me, but he's 100% right. He said, something that people don't realize about the Rav. That wasn't the political statement. I went to the Chag HaSmicha. The Rav, he said, you know, the Rav wasn't just the greatest Talmud, wasn't just a great Talmud. He was the greatest Talmudist of his time. He wasn't just a great Jewish philosopher. He was the greatest Jewish philosopher of his time. He wasn't just a significant Jewish thinker or theologian. He was the greatest theologian of his time. In every area that he was, you know, he wasn't just adequate or very good. He was sui generis. There was no one like him. And each of his Talmidim, each of us, you know, we saw a glimpse of him. And, you know, each of us sort of modeled ourselves after one aspect in much smaller dimension, obviously, in very much in miniature. But no one ever could you know, just, not just that, it wasn't just the breath, but the breath with such extraordinary depth. And that great genius was always, you know, he stood before the mystery of Kodesh Baruch Hu with such humility. And it was the mystery that most intrigued him, both in learning and, you know, the mystery in life, the bittersweet nature of Jewish existence, the dialectic within within Jewish thought. He always used to say, I must have heard it from the Rav 100 times, that Judaism never accepted the Aristotelian, you know, the excluded middle. Somehow we live within the contradiction. But he meant it not only in terms of a logical concept, or I don't know if you would use the word logical, illogical concept in a sense, but it was simply in terms of his very experience. And that was really, that's what he really wanted to communicate, and he would bemoan the fact sometimes not so successfully to his Talmidim. That sense of, you know, the wonder, the extraordinary wonder, especially the way you saw the world through the prism of Halacha, and the universe itself. And because of that, it engendered him, because the sense of wonder, the realization that certain things are incommensurate, beyond human capacity in terms of grasp, it generated him a sense of humility and tolerance. Often tolerance in America, you know, tolerance has become one of the politically correct words that's used nowadays. We have commissions for tolerance and so on. He didn't, when the Rav was tolerant, it wasn't because, you know, the tolerance has come to on occasion to mean also no standards. If there are no standards, then we're tolerant even of deviant behavior. But he was tolerant because he set such extraordinary standards, because he saw this mystery, because he realized that there are things beyond the human ken and beyond the human mind. That was the beauty of the Rav. He was such an extraordinary human being. I used to, from the first day I met the Rav, I was never so astounded by a man like I was at the Rav. I've met presidents and senators and brilliant mathematicians, Nobel Prize. The Rav was so far beyond. I remember the first time I spoke to him as a young boy. I was a high school student. I remember I came to his apartment to speak to him about a boy who was in my class, who was, barely knew me. He knew my family quite well, but he didn't know me at all. And he was so generous, I was so slight and small. And I came to speak to him about what we can do, or what the Rav could do about this person. Because I was, you know, I was concerned in terms of his commitment to Yiddish, about where he was going to end up. And the Rav was concerned, and I said, send him to me. I'm not going to mention his name, obviously. And it was, I remember just the experience, I remember having difficulty mouthing the words as I was about to, because, and I didn't understand his shul, and I was just in high school. But there was such a regal quality about him, such aristocracy. Of course, part of it is because he was the son of such a great family. But it was just, it radiated from his depth. This, you know, such a man of such principle, of such grandeur, of such majesty. You know, and he reflected, I thought, that mystery, which is so much part as he developed in the Shalach and his other work, The Lonely Man of Faith. And, you know, that dilemma, that's the nature of, and his extraordinary curiosity because of it. But curiosity with a sense, not trying of conquest, you know, curiosity just a wonder that never left him. And it was his commitment to truth that he paid on a personal level, the truth, such a high price. He shouldn't have had to pay that price, but he paid a very high price for it. It was because he was such a committed person, so decent, so kind, so honest. He was literally without peer. And this is his 50th yahrzeit. I think about the Rav, now the day goes by that I don't mention his name in my shroom or that I think about him. He should really serve as a model for us as a community, not just here in Bergen County, but really such a Torah giant that we had this chus contemporaneously with him to glimpse him, even a man who didn't have all the answers. You know, he always would say, I'm just, when he would go through his, I'm just trying to exhaust all the logical possibilities. It was not his nature to be, you know, people say he was a posik, he wasn't a posik. In his nature, he wasn't a, like Ezra Chaim wasn't a posik. Because, you know, he saw all the different sides, and it was just because he had this grasp and this humility, and he saw this mystery. So, posik, this is the final, ultimately, posik has to come. This is it, you know. Who says this is it? Maybe there's always, you know, this. He was always intrigued by nuance. We live in a generation where nuance means nothing. Everything is so obvious. Everything is so, I'm talking to the religious community. You know, that sense, and because of that, we, you know, some parts of our, just some things become so pedestrian. The wonder is gone. The religious observance is much deeper, maybe higher standard, but the wonder is certainly gone, as it was in, you know, in his eyes. And as I think about him now at his 50 yard site, and I, you know, I always think about these two Yom Tovim, Yom Kippur and Pesach, that he used to somehow, those were, you know, he would, there was actually one other day on the Jewish calendar, Ikre Moed, Tisha B'Av.